Welcome, everybody, to the second part in a three-part series hosted by NS Perg on Canada's response to the Israeli mission in Lebanon and Gaza. The first of this series had notable speakers such as Alexa McDonough, Bruce Wark, Dr. Maggie Abdul-Masseh, and Larry Haven. The panel was meant to represent a cross-section of perspectives from civil society to government and academia. Tonight's panel will focus specifically on the role of the Canadian media in the Middle East conflict. With us tonight, we have independent Canadian journalist Stefan Christoph. Welcome. So my name is Ardith Wynot, and I'm volunteering to be your moderator for the evening. I'm a youth worker with Love, Leave Out Violence. We believe that there is no clear line between victim and perpetrator, as it's the case that many perpetrators have been victimized themselves. And we deal with youth on all spectrums, or on all points of the spectrum of violence, from victim to perpetrator to witness. NS Perg, the Nova Scotia Public Interest Research Group, who is hosting tonight's event, is a nonprofit, nonpartisan social and environmental justice research and resource center. They're located at Dalhousie University. NS Perg's mandate is to empower, educate, and inspire action on social justice issues here in Nova Scotia. They are a student and volunteer-driven organization working within an anti-oppression framework. To find out more about upcoming NS Perg events and related campaigns, you can visit their website at www.nsperg.org. So, very last thing I'm going to say is many thanks to Cheryl Black and the Spring Garden Library for the use of this space and promotional assistance, and much appreciation also to the Halifax Peace Coalition for their generous contribution towards this important event. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Stefan Christoph, reporter with the Daily Star, the largest English newspaper in the Arab world, programmer with CKUT Radio in Montreal, and co-founder of Tadamon, a Montreal-based collective of media activists working to build relationships of solidarity with grassroots political movements for social and economic justice between Beirut and Montreal. So now I'm going to turn it over to Stefan.
Well, thank you to all the organizations, groups that were involved tonight, thank you to everybody who put effort into putting on not only this event, but the entire series to focus on the Middle East and the situation on the ground in the region. I would have to warn you, I heard about the last event and the presence of Alexi McDonough. I think what I'm going to have to say tonight is a bit different from what you probably heard from Alexi McDonough. But anyways, what I'm basically going to talk about is my experience in Lebanon this summer. I was a reporter at the Daily Star that was mentioned before. It's an English language daily in Beirut, distributed throughout Lebanon and other countries in the Middle East. Also in Beirut, I was working with a group called Tadamon that was mentioned before. We're a group of social justice activists with a particular focus on media, but definitely we are a group that's focused on political activism also. We formed in 2005 in response to the major political changes that were taking place in Lebanon specifically, but also throughout the entire Middle East region in the context of the Bush War of Terror. We felt it was very important to develop a particular focus on Lebanon, specifically in Montreal, because of the massive Lebanese community in the city. Montreal is home to one of the largest Lebanese communities in diaspora, in the world. And so we wanted to develop relationships of solidarity with activists who are working on the ground in Beirut and throughout the country in Lebanon, and movements for social and economic justice back home. This was not an effort aimed to try and, you know, build a relationship of charity, but a relationship of genuine solidarity. So building joint campaigns, having joint projects. That's the kind of, let's say, broad overview of what Tadamon does. But I'm going to first address some of the situation this summer, the Israeli assault, the Israeli attack on Lebanon. I'm also going to be talking about what's happened in the country since February 2005, which is when the former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri was assassinated. Also, I'll be talking about the events in Lebanon that are happening currently, which I'm sure you're all following on the news. First, I'm going to start with Montreal. As I mentioned, it's home to one of the largest Lebanese communities in the diaspora. Some estimates put the number at 100,000. Some estimates put the number at 250,000. I think it's generally assumed that there's about, you know, more than 100,000 Lebanese in Montreal. So it creates a very explosive dynamic in terms of a political response to the situation on the ground in the Middle East, and specifically the Israeli attack on Lebanon this summer. There was a very strong response from the Lebanese community, more broadly also from all of Montreal, where we had the largest demonstrations to show our support and solidarity with the Lebanese people as they are falling prey to the Israeli brutal assault on the country. But a piece of history, a lot of people talk about the Arab and Muslim community in Canada as, you know, especially after 9/11, as a community that has witnessed, experienced persecution, racial profiling, and a certain amount of legislative attacks against it. We can look at this in the context of immigration law, if we're talking about laws around deportations, detentions, of also the indefinite detention of non-citizens in the case of security certificates, which allows that indefinite detention of non-citizens. And currently, well, at least until recently, there was 5 people detained in Canada under security certificates, all of which were Arab and Muslim. So there was a concerted, I would say, attack on the basic civil liberties of Arabs and Muslims in Canada after 9/11. It was definitely stepped up. But I would argue that that's not an attack that began on the date September 11th, but one that stretches far back into history. And I think that the Lebanese community in Montreal, or let's say the Syrian Lebanese community, provides an interesting example. There's of course, a long-standing community, and it was actually in 1882 that the first Syrian Lebanese immigrated to Montreal. That was a man from the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. He settled in Montreal's in the old city of Montreal in 1882, and developed the first foundations of a strong Arab community in the city. But we don't only have to look at 9/11 to look at a history of persecution against Arabs and Muslims. We can look all the way back into the 1920s and 30s, when migration from Arab countries, from the Middle East, started to increase. What we saw was actually legalized persecution of those migrants. There was certain immigration laws passed that actually prohibited the ability from people from the Middle East to migrate. There was, for example, the Continuous Journey Act that was passed in the early 1900s, which basically said that any immigrants coming to Canada, and that was a Canadian act, had to arrive in Canada on a continuous journey, which meant one trip. So say if you were coming from Syria, obviously you were traveling through the Mediterranean, you're going to stop on your way and then to Canada. Under the Continuous Journey Act, which specifically affected Arabs and Muslims that were immigrating to Canada at the time, basically it made immigration impossible. And then there was a later act that was passed around the rights of Asiatic migrants, which basically prohibited any immigration, except if the immigrant was related to somebody who was already a Canadian citizen. These are all laws on the books from Immigration Canada from the early 1900s. So I'm only saying this, and I know that tonight's focus is on Lebanon and focus on the Middle East, but I think when looking at the political situation in the Middle East and understanding how Arab and Muslim communities in Canada are responding to the situation, we have to root our analysis and understanding in history, right? And this history of persecution is very important to understand because it informs and creates the basis in which the community views the country, the Arab and Muslim community. So that history of persecution, legislated persecution, did not begin in 9/11. It dates back to the early 1900s with the settlement of the Lebanese and Syrian migrants, and of course at other periods in history. But it's interesting to note that back then, actually, the community resisted. They wrote petitions. They held a picket in Old Montreal in the early 1920s to protest the immigration reforms that were being put into place. More recently, I'll go now to the 9/11 reference point. We saw an increase of deportations, many people from Lebanon being deported. I myself worked with a group called the Coalition Against the Deportation of Palestinian Refugees, the majority of which were from the refugee camps of Lebanon, who lived in Montreal. And after 9/11, many of their immigration claims were refused. We have to remember these are stateless people. These are people who are born refugees without a passport, without a country, without any basic civil or social rights, coming to Canada to seek status. These people were denied status by the Canadian state and after that point deported from the country, a lot of them. Some of them took up a public fight, organized demonstrations, organized pickets, and organized a public response and actually won their papers. That's a more recent example of the response of the Arab and Muslim community to this institutionalized persecution that exists in the country. I'm saying all this because I think that domestic policy informs foreign policy. We can't make a distinction between what is happening on the ground domestically and what is happening abroad. So it's no mistake that when Paul Martin was in power and he declared in 2005 that Canada's values are Israel's values, which essentially is a declaration of war on the rights of Palestinians, that at home he was deporting Palestinian refugees. We can't make that distinction. It's an important connection to make. And when Harper called the Israeli assault on Lebanon this summer that essentially destroyed the entire civil infrastructure of the country, when he called it a measure response, we cannot look at that as separate from the domestic persecution of Arabs and Muslims that exists in our country today. The two are connected. Domestic policy informs foreign policy. It's not only around immigration. I mean, this summer in and of itself, and I printed out this article because actually Drew wrote it for the Dominion, and it's a very interesting piece, and it talks about the role of Canadian arms manufacturers in the country. So domestic policy informs foreign policy. So, for example, in Montreal, we are talking about massive Canadian corporations that are playing a very significant role in arming and equipping both the U.S. military and the Israeli military. And, these are not broad strokes. There's very specific instances. This article mentions a couple of specific companies, such as CMC Electronics, who takes part in making parts for the infrared guider systems, radar equipment for F-15s. Parts that are sold to Israel to make up F-15s that actually fly over the skies of Gaza, over the skies of the West Bank, over the skies of southern Lebanon, breaking the sound barrier, but more importantly, unleashing bombs. So, this is a Canadian-based corporation that's making profit off of the suffering and the death in the Middle East. So the point is that the connections need to be made between domestic and foreign. And it's no mistake that Stephen Harper, when he talks about a measured response for Israel, the government of the Conservatives, but also before then, the Liberals, were very involved in essentially a process of absolute criminalization of movements in the Middle East that fought and resisted occupation. We're talking about the Lebanese armed resistance movement and also political party Hezbollah. Now, of course, this summer, Hezbollah made headlines across the country. This is a party that is a matter of intense debate, both within Canadian society and within the Arab community itself. But I think that, one very interesting point of history to look at is how Hezbollah, the political party and the military wing, made itself onto the terrorist list in Canada. Let's look at the origins of the movement for a minute. And I think rooting ourselves in history better informs our understanding of what's happening today. Hezbollah emerged in 1985. It was a movement that was predominantly made up of groupings of Shia Lebanese and also representatives from other religious communities in Lebanon, but predominantly Shia Lebanese in the country. They, in 1985, issued a letter to the oppressed people of Lebanon and the world, that's how it was worded, and announced themselves as a resistance movement, Why did this happen? It didn't happen in thin air. It happened in the context of an Israeli occupation of the south of Lebanon. It was a response to that occupation, right? And it was only in 2000 that Israel withdrew from the south, right? This is an important piece of recent history that I think a lot of the Canadian media, such as the Globe and Mail, completely glossed over this summer. You know, we are reading editorials from the editor of the Globe and Mail essentially cheerleading the Israeli Defense Forces and their actions in Lebanon, while at the same time criminalizing entire segments of the Lebanese population who are legitimately resisting the invasion of their country. So it was only in 2000 that Hezbollah and other resistance movements in Lebanon actually successfully pushed Israelis off their soil, 6 years before the war this summer. That was a long fight. Israel entered the south of Lebanon in the late 1970s. We have to remember that that occupation of the south is completely illegal. There's no basis in international law. There's no justification in any code of any international convention to occupy a foreign country. I mean, I'd like to hear one if there is one, but I have never seen any citation made by any Israeli official that successfully justifies their occupation of the south of Lebanon. And some of the most critical voices of that occupation were Israelis themselves, who are dissidents within the country. So when we are looking at the attack this summer, it's important to also think about what happened up until 2000, when Israel occupied the south of Lebanon. What did that mean? They occupied the south. They had checkpoints. They were financing a local army called the South Lebanese Army, which was essentially Israel's proxy army in the south of Lebanon. They were maintaining a brutal prison. This is a famous prison called Khayyam Prison, in which people were tortured, hundreds of people detained without trial, without charge, many people actually dying within that prison. All of this taking place within Israel's occupation of the south of Lebanon. So Hezbollah, during that period, in the lead up to the withdrawal of 2000, became stronger. It was a reaction to the Israeli occupation of the south, where you had an occupied people resisting a foreign army. I'd like to make a point of distinction also in terms of Hezbollah. I think there's often, when we discuss this issue, we look at the south and the resistance to the Israeli occupation in the south as simply Hezbollah. But it was actually at the time in the late 1990s and early 1990s, large segments of the Lebanese population played a very active role in the resistance against the Israeli occupation of the south. For example, the Lebanese Communist Party played a very significant role and lost many of its members to Israeli bullets and bombs. Also, many others from Lebanese society. So anyways, this organization, which actually, if you look at history and understand where it emerged from, which is Israeli occupation and a resistance to foreign military occupation, was placed on the terrorist list in Canada. We know why it was placed on the terrorist list. Hezbollah represented a threat to imperialist interests in the Middle East. And I don't mean to be rhetorical, but I mean, let's be, when we talk about imperialist interests in the Middle East, what are we really talking about? We're talking about a state, a colonial state, the state of Israel, founded on dispossession, founded on the displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees in 1948, occupying indigenous local people placing economic and political designs on the region for their own benefit. That is imperialism. Israel's actions and their support from the United States is imperialism. So Hezbollah was placed on the terrorist list in 2002. The circumstance in which it was placed on the terrorist list, and it's actually explained in this book, which is free at the door, is really interesting because essentially it was based on this report that was produced in the National Post. We all know what a credible news service the National Post is. Basically, the National Post announced that Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, had condoned and encouraged suicide bombings. It was later uncovered by investigative journalists at the CBC, Neil McDonald, who's a very respected, relatively progressive journalist at the CBC, that the report that was issued in the National Post that provided the justification for putting Hezbollah on the terrorist list in 2002 was completely fabricated. He did an extensive report on it, and on the national news proved that it was a complete fabrication. And it was a fabrication by a Lebanese man who had basically said that through translation, Nasrallah had encouraged suicide bombings around the world. This is something Nasrallah never said. They went over the tapes. It never happened. So essentially that categorization of Hezbollah as terrorists in law in Canada, which means we shouldn't be talking about it right now, was done on complete falsification. So this is domestic policy. I mean, there's so many details to talk about, but domestic policy informs foreign policy. I keep repeating this phrase because I think it's often lost in a lot of the work that we do. You know, when we march on the streets, when we take to the streets in response to, you know, for example, the Israeli assault on Lebanon this summer, I think the domestic policy of what is happening internally within our country really informs well and gives us more of an ability to understand what the nature of our foreign policy is. You know, I just read another piece recently. It was on the 21st of November. This is just an example of the persecution and the ways in which these anti-terror legislations are used against people to promote fear, to promote terror, essentially, amongst marginalized communities here in North America. In the United States, two men now have been charged with terrorist offenses in New York for allegedly providing access to a television station banned in the United States called Al Manar. Al Manar is a television station that has links to Hezbollah. It's a very popular television station in Lebanon. These two men are facing up to 110 years in prison simply for providing satellite links to this television station. No formal connection to Al Manar Television, which is not even a political entity or a military entity, but is a media entity. These two men are being charged in New York City under the anti-terror legislation and facing 110 years in prison for providing access to an alternative news service concerning the Middle East. I mean, alternative to the news service that we get through the corporate hacks of CTV and the National Post. Now, in terms of this summer in Lebanon, and I think in terms of understanding the gravity of what happens, and I think often we act with amnesia. And I think the mainstream media plays a certain role in developing that political amnesia. And what I mean by that is that inability to remember just how brutal what happened in Lebanon this summer was. What happened essentially was the complete destruction of the country. The bombing of over 90 civilian bridges, the bombing of fuel plants, the bombing of the international airport, the bombing of food depots, the bombing of Red Cross vans, the bombing of water treatment plants, the bombing of sewage plants, the bombing of electrical plants, the bombing of television stations, the bombing of civilian shelters, and the list goes on. Anything that Israel could hit that would institute a sense of fear and terror amongst Lebanese people during that summer, they hit. And that's the reality of what happened. And I was just reading about the assassination that took place about 48 hours ago in Beirut of a Lebanese a parliament minister. I'll speak a bit more on that later. And Bush was quoted recently in a Reuters report that he would sustain a drumbeat of solidarity with Lebanon and Prime Minister Fouad Siniora. And this was in response to the assassination that recently happened. I don't know where Bush's drumbeat of solidarity was this summer when 1,300 people died. It wasn't there. Actually, there was a drumbeat of solidarity for Israel and the Israeli assault on the country. And this brings up an important point, which is often people talk about, you know, the fact that Canada and Harper's response this summer was, in a sense, delayed, not adequate. It was a response that did not adequately deal with the situation on the ground in Lebanon and the 40,000 Canadian citizens that were in the country. I would argue to say that Harper's response to the war in Lebanon this summer was not slow. It wasn't delayed. He responded very quickly. He responded within hours, expressing his overt solidarity for the Israeli military assault. Within hours of the first day of the attacks, calling it a measured response. That is a very rapid response. It is a response that chooses a side and essentially dehumanizes the entire population of Lebanon, who bore the brunt of the civilian tragedy that was bestowed upon the country this summer. I was there during the war. It's not an experience that you forget easily. As I talked about the bombings, it's very, very difficult to comprehend the state of terror, the state of fear, the state of helplessness that a lot of people in Lebanon were experiencing during the first days of the bombing. One of the key things that the Israelis did within the first 48 hours, really, was they knocked out successfully a lot of the cell phone transmitting towers, right? And then the electrical grid, the electrical plants. So what does that do? Essentially, it starts a halt of communications. So when they're hitting the south, when they're hitting villages in the south, when they're hitting villages in the far east, when they're hitting villages in the north, nobody can talk to each other, right? So everybody's lost, in a sense. I mean, there was some communication, but when the cell phones started breaking down and you didn't know exactly where they're hitting and the power generators went off and the television stations went off, you had no idea what was going on. All you could hear is the roar of the airplanes and the explosions of the bombs. I mean, so essentially what it was at that point was to an attempt to completely institute a sense of fear and panic amongst the people. But I would say that was an effort that failed, obviously. I mean, the Lebanese people are familiar with war, sadly. They've lived through literally decades of war and can deal with it in a sense. What I mean by deal with it is comprehend how to act in a situation of war. And I think that was the distinctive difference that one of the important, let's say, points this summer between what happened in Israel and what happened in Lebanon in terms of the civilian response is that people in Lebanon were familiar with war, so they could deal with it. There was no complex shelter system in Lebanon as there was in Israel, but people know how to deal with it because they'd experienced it before, whereas it was the first time in so many years that Israel actually had experienced bombings, right? And that's why there was such an incredible response, I think, on the Israeli behalf. So, I mean, the war this summer, there's the massacres we know about, and there's the massacres that we didn't know about. I mean, obviously, the massacre of Khana in early August, where we saw dozens upon dozens of Lebanese civilians losing their lives, bombed in a shelter, was one of the more publicized massacres, but there was many more. I mean, here's one that happened on the 16th of July. I remember very distinctly, there's 21 civilians that were killed in 1 minute by Israeli strike. They were in a bus. They were leaving a village in the south to go to another southern city called Tir. They're bombed in the afternoon. They're a civilian bus completely shelled, destroyed. 21 people died. These were women and children who were fleeing the fighting. So there was no attempt to differentiate between civilians, combatants, Hezbollah, non-Hezbollah. That didn't exist. And I think it's very important that we understand that about the summer, because it was a complete attack on all of the country. And I think that, you know, when we talked about the targeting of Hezbollah, it's important to think about it in a sense that when you talk about targeting Hezbollah, you're talking about targeting a huge portion of the population, because a huge portion of the population supports Hezbollah. I think, you know, our group, Tadamon in Montreal, makes certain distinctions with Hezbollah, but I mean, we do recognize very really the reality that they are a very popular social, political, and resistance movement in the country. And I think that we as activists in Canada or social justice organizers have to come to terms with that's the fact that Hezbollah is a popular voice in the country. Now, I have to end basically, but I just want to say one other thing, which is a bit about Tadamon. And our work. Tadamon is a group, as I mentioned at the very beginning, that's working to try and build these connections with Lebanon. Now, we worked very hard over the last 2 years to build extensive links with activist networks in the country. And we have successfully established links with a group called Samidun, which means standing, like steadfastness in Arabic. Basically, Samidun is a group that provided their grassroots relief group, and they provided aid to tens of thousands of people in the country. It was a grassroots response to the war. They weren't fighters, but they did see themselves as part of the resistance because they were assisting the civilians in Lebanon who are bearing the brunt of the war. So we've established this link with Samidoun, and we're trying to build closer political ties with movements in Lebanon, movements that operate outside of the nexus of the major political powers in the country, more grassroots movements. I did say a lot of things about Hezbollah during this talk, and I think it's important we recognize these things about Hezbollah, the fact that they are popular, the fact that they are a people's movement in the country, while also recognizing the diversity of resistance that exists in Lebanon. I mean, it's not only Hezbollah that is resisting in Lebanon. We have to also remember that this summer it was upwards of, in total, about 80% of the population that supported the national resistance. It wasn't just Hezbollah, it was a vast majority of the country. And resistance comes in many forms. The people in Samidoun who were providing aid for the thousands upon thousands of displaced refugees were resisting in their own way also. And sincerely, I think it's important we understand that as a mode of resistance also, responding in a grassroots way to the war. So I guess I have to finish. There's too much to say about Lebanon. There's a lot of complexities that are left out by the mainstream media in terms of understanding the situation on the ground. I tried to provide for you a bit of perspective from somebody who spent a lot of time in the country, understands some of the nuances of the politics there, while also an important campaign for Tadaman is addressing this issue of Hezbollah being on the terrorist list, while another important campaign of ours is building links with Lebanon, and all the information is on the table in the back. I'll guess I'll leave it there. Please, if you do have questions, I would like to talk to you about what happened in Lebanon this summer and about the situation today. I would have liked to talk about the assassination, but maybe we can address that in the question and answer period. Thank you.
Thank you, Stefan.
You have been listening to Stefan Christoff, independent journalist, speaking on Canada's response to Israel's involvement in Lebanon this summer. Talk took place November 23rd, 2006 at the Spring Garden Road Memorial Library, produced for CKDU-FM.